afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Oh, so much better, boys, than the first hour. Whoa. We were kind of discombobulated the first hour. That was very pro there.
Oh, we got our game on now.
Lucky for our guest, Peter Cove, we're all warmed up. We're all organized now. So no more buffoonery. Well, I'm sure buffoonery will slip in later.
Far. Yeah.
We promise not to judge you.
Exactly. We talked about fake news in the judiciary on the first hour, so if you missed that, hit the archive at wethepeopleradio.us and you can catch up. So Peter Cove is a nationally acclaimed advocate for private solutions to the welfare dependency. And I think this would be a really hot topic right now everywhere, and we're so lucky to have him on here. He has written a new book called Poor No More, and you kind of have to be careful how you say it, otherwise it sounds like it's a different issue. But the subtitle here figures it out for you, Rethinking Dependency and the War on Poverty. He founded America Works, the first for-profit welfare-to-work company. He's created more than 1 million jobs for welfare recipients throughout through America Works and other private sector endeavors. For 50 years, he has been at the forefront of mitigating poverty by promoting jobs as a solution to welfare dependency. Imagine that. It can be done. He previously served in key posts in New York City municipal government, charitable foundations, and private companies. We are super excited because this is the thing that everybody says can't happen. So this hour will be all about
how it can happen.
How it can happen.
Now it has happened.
Peter, happy to have you on here.
Well, thank you, Erin and Bill. I really appreciate being on.
Yeah, well, we have a ton to talk about.
Everybody says this can't take place. Well, you've been doing it for a long time. This, I guess, we should have called it the best-kept secret, huh?
Well, I'm not sure it's a secret to some of the 1 million or more people that we've placed in jobs or the government that we've helped reduce public dependency, but maybe overall throughout the United States it is a secret, and there's probably a good reason for that, which we can get into a little later, and it has to do with the welfare industrial complex that we have in the United States that keeps good ideas and good programs from emerging and rising to the top.
So is this a book that came over a long period of time? Obviously, you've been involved in this 50 years, or did you just say, you know what, this is crazy. People need to understand this idea.
Yeah, why'd you write this book?
Well, I sat down a few years ago to write the book about what had happened in our country since I started in the War on Poverty in 1965, and what I saw was that in 1965, when Lyndon Johnson got the War on Poverty started, the poverty rate in the United States was about 15.5%. And as I began writing the book a few years ago, the poverty rate was about 15.1%. But we had spent over 50 years over 22 trillion, not billion, $22 trillion to solve the problem. And we hadn't moved the needle much. And I looked at it. It was kind of a mea culpa moment for me. I looked at this and I said, well, I was involved in this. And while I think some of the things I did may have worked, but my God, what we did didn't work overall. We spent over $22 trillion. And I said, I got to figure out what happened? Why was that? I mean, I had some clues, but I really had to dig in, and that brought me to the book's conclusion, which we can get to later on in terms of how to solve poverty in the United States. But I really found myself exploring what had happened when I started being a foot soldier in the War on Poverty. And then looking back and realizing in the War on Poverty, poverty won. And that was very disheartening. And so I wrote the book to kind of expunge that part of my life, take a look at it, and then go forward.
Yeah, and I think that's your book, I think, is a topic that so many people have thought about, talked about, maybe had...
But you're a hater if you bring it up.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the idea
you've had your own ideas on how to solve it, but you've just kept quiet about it because you know how it's going to go over. But how have you...
Well, I'd like to hear how it works.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
A little bit more on how your program works, because obviously it does work.
Yeah, well, the proposal I have in the book isn't just for my program, but let me talk to you a little bit about the program, because it is significant, and it's been copied, and I'm glad of that. And there are many other organizations that are now doing what we do in New York and throughout the country. And we are, by the way, America Works is all over the country. We're in California as well. We place not just welfare recipients right now, but also ex-offenders, kids maxing out of the foster care system, veterans who are homeless. We really get to deal with people who normally would not have access to the labor market. And the way we do that, which I think was your question, is we act pretty much like an employment agency. Think of Manpower, Inc., or Kelly, or any of the ones you go to get a job. So you go there, and what do? Well, we do the same thing. We do more, though, but we begin by finding out where the jobs are. We have salespeople that go out to companies and secure job openings. And then we take the people that we have, we match them to those jobs, send them out for interviews. And once hired, actually, that's when our job really begins. Unlike regular employment agencies, we provide backup for the line management for the people, so that if there's anything that's getting in their way in the job, such as an abusive maid at home, or the daycare falls out, or a housing issue, or a transportation issue, or not understanding the mores of the workplace, we have staff that go out and work with the individual and the line manager, make sure the person succeeds. I say that the people have the static in their lives, many of them, not all of them, but many of them. And what we do is put a protective cocoon around that so that if they're a good worker, we help them to stay in the job.
Well,
it's really the model.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective, because if you look at what we've done, you know, this war on poverty, it's you know, get these people educated, get them trained. And how many people come out of college with a huge education and can't find a job? That, I think, you're right, is the wrong approach. I mean, granted, training and education is important, but jobs are important. Let's figure out how to put these people to work.
But most of the time you do find, and we see that with people that we all work with, the static in their lives. I think that's a good way to term it.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it really makes the difference between a person staying in the job and leaving. It really is less what they know. It's more that kind of issue. And, yes, I have a lot in my book about the failure of education and training. No one's against education and training. It's where it fits and what you expect of it. And what we did in our country is we put it up front in terms of reducing welfare rolls, for instance. And instead of getting people quickly into jobs and then using the education and training to move them up in the job, We did it in reverse, and it didn't work. It was poor education for poor folk. I used to argue with Senator Monahan, who was a great senator, and analyzed the issue of dependency and growing dependency, particularly in the African-American community, on welfare and how it was breaking up the families. But his answer was education and training. I go into his office and I say, listen, we're running programs. You're an academic. He had a PhD. I'm not an academic. I said, but what I am is someone on the ground working with poor people, and I know what they need. And it's not to sit in another classroom where they've been failed by the education system.
So,
and he would disagree with me. He totally would disagree with me. Finally, I walked in one day, and his chief of staff said, well, Cove, you were right. And I didn't even know what he was talking about. He said, well, there's some research, and the research now shows that education and training is not the best way for a first strike in reducing welfare rolls. It's getting them a job.
Yep.
So what you're
saying...
Because
if they have some way to apply it, it's worth getting the education.
Right.
Otherwise, they're just...
So I think what you're saying is on-the-job training would be, in the long run, more valuable than spending years in college and work training programs and then going out and looking for a job. Am I getting that?
Absolutely. I mean, the companies know what they need. They know
right.
specifically what they're going to need the next day. Now, is some training up front for some jobs appropriate? Of course it is. But generally speaking, it doesn't work very well for the people I'm dealing with. What works is getting them in there and then, using education and on-the-job training to move them up in the job. That really does work.
Sure, because then, you know, you've helped them with the hurdles, getting there on time, being dressed appropriately, having, just your basic skill set match so that they can get a paycheck.
Right.
And then, they feel like they're getting somewhere. People feel good about that.
But, it makes a lot of sense to take that money and give it to employers to train people to do what they need rather than give it to people for training so that they can go out and find a job in maybe a field where there is no need.
I don't know what the number is now, but let's face it, most people with a college degree don't do anything related to the field they studied.
Right.
Well, that's right.
Every time I've ever heard statistics on that, the numbers were huge.
They're horrible.
They are horrible.
One of the things I suggest in the book is something that we've done at America Works. It's what you were talking about a couple of minutes ago. In the way we've done it, on-the-job training money from the federal government has been available for decades, but it's failed pretty much because it's been so bureaucratic, as you would expect from the federal government. And they just don't understand how the private sector works. What we did, we had money and from the government. And what we did is we went to companies and we said, tell you what, hire this person, put them on your payroll. They said, well, we don't have that money right now. Can you afford half the salary? So, okay, yeah. Well, we'll pay you half the salary for 3 months. See how they do. Then, at the next 2 months, we'll pay you a quarter of the salary. Then, after that, pick them up and put them on if they're working. And that worked because they got a chance to see the person. It deferred the cost for the company, and it worked tremendously well. We created so many jobs by doing that. The federal government, they'll say, well, we'll give you a tax credit. Well, a tax credit isn't very good for you if you're losing money. A tax credit, even if you're making money, you won't see that return for a year, year and a half anyway,
right,
from the government. So every month, we gave the company a check. They showed us the payroll register, and the person was there. We gave them a check for 50% of the wages for, as I said, 3 months, and then et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, you really can do it, and then they train the person.
That's a cool idea. We have a lot more to discuss with you, Mr. Cove. We need to take a really quick break, however, and we will be right back. Our guest today is Peter Cove. We're talking about Poor No More, Breaking the Cycle of Dependency, and the War on Poverty. So for all those of you that are sick of that, this is all about solutions. What a great hour. We'll be right back.
So many lies, you twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Dip, 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 dip.
Get a job.
It's nice we get to have different music. We've never had a get a job program. Obviously, that's what's wrong with our country. We've been doing this for years, never did a get a job program. So I'm stealing right directly from your the things that your publicist sent us, but here is one of the possible questions they gave us, and I just don't want to mess it up. It said, Poor No More contends that the only thing that successfully reduced poverty is work itself. which is the centerpiece of the bipartisan welfare reform bill in 1996. In the 90s, when the federal government embraced the work-first ideal, welfare rolls plummeted from 12.6 million to 4.7 million nationally within one decade. Why is work so critical to poverty alleviation? I mean, I don't know. That kind of answers itself. But do you support the Civilian Conservation Corps-style public work relief? And what do we do about the people who can't work? It's kind of like nine questions all in one, but
yeah.
But you've got the same list I do, I hope so.
Well, yeah, I do believe work is the solution. Unfortunately, particularly on the left in our country politically, work has become a four-letter word when
yes.
it comes to asking people who are dependent but are able-bodied to work. As an example, when President Obama was in office, his administration came to New York and told us that we could not continue to place people who were on food stamps and were able-bodied into jobs.
Why?
We had found, you have to ask the government why they do that. It's a pattern, though, I have to tell you, of trying to be nice, not forcing people to do things. Not having a reciprocal responsibility, which was the keystone of the 96 welfare reform bill that was passed, bipartisan bill, Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, and it said, if you're on welfare and you're able-bodied and there is a job, then you have to work. You have to go to work. And daycare will be provided, but you've got to go to work. And it's been eroding in this country. Obama eroded a lot of it through directives to states. He eroded it with food stamp recipients who were not then told they should go to work, even though that is part of the law. Work is the answer. And yet we find that people think we're being cruel to ask people who are receiving from government assistance to go to work. I'm going to tell you something. I've been in this business over 50 years, and I know I don't look it. You can tell me that. But the truth is that people who I deal with, poor people, do want to work. They want that self-aggrandizement. They want to be able to show their children what they can do. And our government gets in the way. It puts all kinds of obstacles and doesn't put the kind of incentives that we need. It is really not that there are a lot of bums in this country, and sure, there's some bums. I have some friends that are bums, but most people really want to work, but the government gets in the way.
And so, what's in it for the? I mean, is it just that the government has programs and people who run the programs, and they keep getting bigger, and they can have more programs, and they can do housing and this and that and the other? And it seems like it's all about the infrastructure of bureaucracy rather than successfully completing the mission.
Well, that's absolutely true. There's a joke in my industry: if it doesn't work, double the funding. I mean, it's basically that. But
yes.
Let me give you an anecdote to begin to give you a sense of what the welfare industrial complex is, what I call it in this country, and why it keeps bad programs going and doesn't let good ones in. There was a woman who was in the state assembly in New York State. She headed the welfare committee. She came to visit my company, America Works, and see our welfare to work program. We took her around. She saw it. I said, "What do you think?" She said, "I think it's the best welfare to work program I've ever seen." I said, "Are you going to support it?" She said, "No." I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, there's a small little program down the street from my campaign office. They're not as big as yours, Peter. They run a welfare-to-work program. Not as big. It's not as good. But on election day, they bring out the votes."
Wow.
That's what goes on. And here was a woman who, very liberal Democrat, went in for all the good reasons to help people, but had no qualms about selling out poor people to keep a job.
Wow.
You know, it's kind of what we think is going on, but nice of you to be able to report that.
I wish it wasn't.
Well, no kidding.
But that is what goes on. And you have all of these programs that support politicians and continue to get funding. Now, this isn't everywhere all the time. And in fact, I'll tell you something that America Works has done to try to change that game, and we have in New York City and in some other cities as well. But it does go on, and what we've done is we've had government start to pay for performance so that we only get paid, and other organizations like us in New York and some other cities, only if we get the person off welfare and only if they stay in that job for 3 to 6 months.
Oh.
And that changes the game, because either you stay in business and keep the program going because you're successful, or you go out of business because you haven't been able to place the people and you don't get any money. So that really does change the game. But I'm going to tell you, it's very hard. Politicians really don't like it and don't want it.
Wow. Are you, okay, so like here in our area, and I know this is true in a lot of places, but California's made some very bad decisions. One of the assembly bills it was supposed to be for prison overcrowding, so they pushed a whole bunch of criminals out onto the street. Then it was supposed to be safer schools and safer neighborhoods or some, you know, initiative that went through that the voters voted for that turned a bunch of felonies into misdemeanors. So this was all targeted in large part at drug crimes. So now we have all the drug users living on the street. You know, heroin is, you know, epidemic levels and all that. And I know there are lots of other cities that are dealing with this. But what are you doing with those folks? Like, does your
I'll tell you. We have a program in San Francisco, a company in San Francisco, dealing with ex-offenders. And we have programs all over the country dealing with ex-offenders, people who are coming out. And what we do is very quickly get them into work, which keeps them off the street, which begins to socialize them, re-socialize them into the communities. And it's been phenomenally successful. There have been, one of the things America Works does is we always have research projects on our programs. We want to be sure that even though we think we're doing good, that they really are doing well. And the research that's been done, I won't go into it right now, but there's outside research, including a controlled experimental study, which is the gold standard, which showed that when we got people jobs coming out of jail, we reduced the recidivism rate significantly. And that has been a really big deal for us, because what we've been able to show is that if you so to speak, capture people
for sure,
as soon as they're coming out of jail, and move them very quickly into jobs, you do reduce the rate. Let me give you the most stark example. We had a program in North Carolina, and the program had people who were on the streets, had violent felon convictions, had been in jail. The police identified these people as the most likely to reoffend. Those were the ones that were referred to us. And after a year's period of time, their recidivism rate was about 7%, and the statewide rate was about 35%. And the statewide rate, of course, included a much easier group, all told. So you see what the difference can be when you have programs moving people quickly into jobs who are coming out of jail.
Let me ask you this. I know a lot of feedback I get on this is you've got so many people that have been on public assistance for so long, they are comfortable on it, and they don't necessarily want to work. One of the things that I think you mentioned in your book was that every able-bodied person that can work should work. What do you do with these folks that are perfectly satisfied living on government assistance,
or who are multi-generational,
and don't want to work but want to be on government assistance? What do you do with those folks?
First of all, that I disagree with the basic premise.
Uh-huh. It's a stereotype.
That there are a large group of people out there that don't want to work and can't work and are comfortable. You can't be comfortable on welfare. There's no comfort in it. I mean, you can subsist, but you're not going to be very comfortable. What we do is we have them visualize and see what the opportunity is rather than sitting home and collecting the paycheck. And frankly, the welfare law of 96 says you have to go to work. You just can't stay home. And that, about 8 months ago, the House, I'm sorry, I'm blocking his name, but Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, came to our office in Milwaukee, and he told me that when they take up welfare this coming year, they are going to put work requirements into many of the public programs that keep people home, including disability. And I'll talk a little bit about disability if you want, because we have a large program going on right now, moving people who are disabled into jobs.
Absolutely. Let's take a really quick break and come back and do that. I don't want to cut you off partway, but that's a biggie, because we do have a lot of people who they might not be able to do what they used to do, but it sounds like you have found a way around it.
Yeah, it's the largest growing welfare population in our country.
Oh, well, we're seeing that locally, so I guess those statistics have to start somewhere.
Good.
Unfortunately, we're helping to make them. So we're going to come right back with our guest, Peter Cove. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Get a haircut and get a real job. Get a haircut and get a real job. Clean your act up and don't be a slob. Get it together like your big brother Bob. Why don't you get a haircut and get a real job?
There you go.
Yeah, we knew that was coming.
Is that like the America Works theme song there, Peter?
No, I think get a job is.
Yeah, we don't have to have a real job. Just out of curiosity, before we do the other part,
fake jobs.
What kind of work? I mean, do people just wind up doing a little bit of everything? Is there an industry that lends itself well to this?
Yeah, it kind of is a little bit of everything. It really depends on the skills that people bring. And remember, since we're taking ex-offenders, but we're also taking veterans, who have might have some experience. There are a lot. But let me just give you examples. We place people who are security personnel, home health aides, customer service agents, drivers, food service workers, medical billing, retail associates, office work, IT work, construction. This might interest some people. Someone would say to me, "Well, what do you do with somebody who's coming out of jail and they've got, an eighth grade or ninth grade education, and what are you going to do with them?" And I say, "I'll tell you what we do with them. We put them in the back offices of places, and they're customer service agents on the phone. Some of them, they've been out in the street selling stuff. They've been out doing things. Some of them are terrific at BS." And they're on the phone, and we put them in a back room. They're not going to harm anybody, and they have a great job. So you have to look at what the skill sets are of the people. But there are, as I mentioned, a whole bunch of different things that we place people in. I only gave you a smattering.
Sure. So do you find there's any difference or more difficulty or less difficulty with people who are kind of fresh down on their luck, or people who were maybe raised in a household where perhaps their entire life they lived on public assistance?
If you've been in a lifestyle that has been to be publicly dependent,
that's all you know.
It is harder, but it's not hard. I say it's harder, but not hard. We really are able. You know what happens? You get a person in, and they say, "I can't go. I can't go. I don't have daycare, and anyway, no one wants me, and I'd rather stay home." Let me tell you what's going on there. What's going on there is insecurity about anybody seeing them for anything.
Right.
So we send them out on a job interview. And the company says, okay, she can show up next Monday. And all of a sudden she finds daycare, or she wants the job. She decides that it's a good idea that she now move on and become a productive member of society. What was going on was a lot of insecurity about who she was and who would ever want her, and him too. And I'm just thinking the welfare mother's right for a second. It's a matter of helping them to visualize what a life could be that would be different. Change is hard. The only person that likes change is a wet baby. And it's hard. You have to work with people on this.
You know, one of the things, I don't know, I kind of relate to this a little bit. I had a previous position with a company where I had to hire some help, and we had a position open that was starting at $15 an hour. We were going to train them, and it took me over 2 years to fill that position because people didn't want to come in and start at $15 an hour because they made more money than that on public assistance. They got free medical. So the benefits, you know, when they weighed all the benefits they got for nothing versus a $15 an hour job, they wouldn't take it. And I know that is kind of contrary to what you're saying, but that was
okay. How can you?
That's the facts.
How could you have helped Bill?
Yeah. How would I have gotten over? How do you get over that hump?
Yeah. First of all, when someone goes to take a job, they don't lose all the benefits. For instance, at a $15 an hour job, they'd still be getting food stamps. For instance, they'd still be getting housing assistance. For instance, I mean, I can go on and on.
Sure.
The truth is, once you take a job, doesn't mean everything drops out and you get nothing. In fact, you do better. And what we have are people who work at the intake level, talking with people and showing them exactly what that wage will do for them and what the additional benefits that they're now receiving they can continue to receive while they are working. So it doesn't work like, you know, you go out, you get a job and everything drops out. And by the way, that's one of the things that is really wonderful about a program that we're running for people who are disabled. There's a federal program called Ticket to Work, and we actually have one going in California as well, where we're taking people who are on disability, SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance, and moving them into jobs. This is all voluntary. They're not forced. But voluntarily, they go into jobs. And what the fear would be of anybody on disability would be they'd lose that payment.
Sure.
And what if the company fired them or they had to lay people off or whatever? And what we're able to do is we're able to wean them a bit. They don't go cold turkey. They are able to keep the benefit for quite a bit of time until things are stabilized and they are really working well. And they can go back on later on if they do get terminated for any reason.
Right.
Interesting.
So that, by doing that, though, doesn't that kind of tell the disability folks that you're not really disabled, that you can work? And so then when you go to reapply, they say, well, heck, you worked for the last 8 months and you were able to do the job. Why are you filing for disability now?
They waive that.
They do.
They can go back on. That's a very good point, but they're not held accountable for that.
Oh, well, that's...
Logically, in a way, they shouldn't be, but they're not.
Yeah.
Right, but I mean, actually holding them accountable, although I would normally agree with that, that actually hurts their ability to go out and replace the Social Security income. I mean, it keeps them afraid and not willing to try. So, actually, I think that's a great idea.
It really works. It's really working. And I'll tell you something. We estimate that very conservatively, 30% of people who are on disability, federal disability, can work. And you know what that would save? That would save $50 to $60 billion a year in our country if they went to work.
Absolutely. Well, we constantly, you know, we're always disincentivizing the work. You know, you have to live on this small fixed amount because if you work, you're going to get penalized. So,
right.
I mean, I think
that's absolutely right.
I think the programs are all set up, screwed up to start with. But okay, so one of the things that's I can't believe it. We've only got 15 minutes left. What the heck? So one of the questions that was listed here, and it's the same one I have, is what are the biggest barriers to getting welfare recipients into your program? Like, how do they find you, or how do you find them?
There aren't a lot of barriers of getting them into the program. First of all, if they're on welfare, they are referred by their case manager to come to our company to be placed in jobs. So we get referrals from the welfare departments around the country.
Mm.
If they're a veteran, we have people who work with the veterans associations, and we're known to be able to place people who are veterans into jobs, et cetera. And the same with ex-offenders. It's not hard getting people in. It's getting the jobs and keeping the people in the jobs. And that really, the latter part is the hardest. The hardest is keeping the person in the job. As we talked earlier about that static that goes on.
Right.
That's the real issue. And my wife, Lee Bose, who's the CEO of our company, says once we get a person into a job, that's when our job begins. And that's true. We really getting a person into the job isn't that hard. It's keeping them there that really is the big issue.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me this: how many people actually work in your company? You know, to manage
nationwide, we have around 400 people working in our company.
Okay, that's not very many. I was thinking it would take a lot more people to keep track of, you know, I mean, when you're going to put this many people to work, I guess once they get going, is it a little bit, you know, like airplanes,
right.
If the runway's long enough
exactly.
And there's enough lift, they...
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. The number of people that are having problems at any one time, you know, might be a third or less of the people we place. So they just keep moving along, and we don't need that many people. But 400 people is a lot of people.
Yeah, it's still a lot of people. Tell me this. You were, it says here that you were a real believer in all the, you know, liberal policies, social services, and all that kind of stuff. But then, obviously, you changed your mind. What was the catalyst for that?
Well, the catalyst was running programs and seeing how they worked. And realizing, as I said when I talked to Senator Monahan, that the programs that he wanted didn't work on the ground. They sounded good, but they just didn't work. And so it was an accumulation over the decades of experience. I'm not an academic. That isn't who I am. I'm a person who's run programs, designed programs, evaluated programs. I saw what was real. I saw what worked. And as we moved along, I realized that the programs that we were establishing in 1965 to help people become independent and self-sufficient were just plain not working. And so I started to kind of redesign programs. And the program America Works, I started in 1984 as the first for-profit welfare to work company, because I had experienced some programs that I ran in the not-for-profit sector, and I saw that they were working, that they were getting people jobs, that they were helping companies get good employees and reducing public expenditures. So I decided I wanted to take it on the road, and I set up a private for-profit company to do that. And it really came out of experience. But I'll tell you something. Saul Bellow has a great quote. He said, a great deal of intelligence can be invested in ignorance when the need for illusion is deep. And that really was what was happening. The people in my field were stuck on stupid. They just didn't want to leave what they believed should work, even though it didn't work. And they just kept doing it and kept doing it.
Yeah, you know, and now we look at what's been the new thing has been, you know, all secondary education needs to be free, because if it was all free, then these people would all be able to go to work and all that.
Hey, we need to take a break, but when we come back, let's talk about what do you think the chances of real reform in...
So you don't like my question?
Well, no. No, I like your question.
I haven't been able to give you a bad time at all.
Yeah, no,
2 hours have been really nice. Like,
and I'll discuss my solution as well.
There you go.
You'll have the whole thing when we come back. All right, we're going to bicker off stage here. You're listening to We the People. Our guest is Peter Cove, author of Poor No More. We'll be right back. You can find everything about our guest and our program and any contact information you'd like for us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Yeah, I liked your question. I thought my question was better. I trumped your question.
We'll discuss this off the air.
The hunger's for your love, and I'm waiting in your welfare line. Well, I ain't got nothing but
what the heck is that?
That's a Buck Owens classic.
Nice.
Waiting in your welfare line.
I like it. All right, take it away, Peter.
Speaking of the hungries.
Speaking of the hungries.
You're going to give us an update?
All right, let us... Let us hear all about the solutions.
Absolutely. As I thought about how I would create a way in which to reduce dependency in this country, because it really is dependency that we're talking about, I decided that the way to do it is to get rid of all welfare, except for people who physically or mentally cannot go to work. That we should get rid of all poverty programs, because, as we indicated earlier in the show, we've spent over $22 trillion, and it hasn't worked.
Right.
And take all that money, and it's a lot of money, and create jobs in the private sector, and when there isn't enough, and when we don't have enough there, create them in the public sector, and say to a woman who's had a child and comes to government for money, no, but you can have a job in daycare. And isn't that what we all want? Isn't that what people do want? They want to work. Isn't that what society wants? Rather than taking our money, which is being spent now, and sending it to people to sit home, I'm suggesting let's take that money and create the jobs so they can work. To me, that's such a better solution for our country.
Sure, and it is. I don't think anybody would. Well, okay, there would be. I think most people would agree with that. Most people just don't think it'll work, but. You guys, of course, have proven that obviously it does work.
Yeah, I think it would work, and I think politicians, and I suggest this in the book, politicians would be interested in this because instead of handing out contracts for programs that don't work, they'd be handing out jobs for people to go to in states all around the country. We used to have a situation where we had patronage in this country, where that is what politicians did. They handed out jobs to their people who voted for them and others. And it worked. I'd like to see us doing that for everybody who's poor and unemployed, the politicians creating those jobs with the exact same money. My proposal is budget neutral. It doesn't cost any more money to do what I'm suggesting. In fact, it costs less, and you get people out there working instead of staying home and collecting a paycheck. And as I indicated earlier to both of you, people would rather work than not work.
So you're not implying that the federal government create businesses. You're saying give that money to existing businesses to expand and employ more people.
Exactly. The way I suggested the wage supplementation, which we talked about earlier, in terms of getting money to companies to offset the cost of wages for a period of time. And then, as I said, if there aren't enough jobs in the private sector, then we would have the opportunity to establish WPA and other public programs for people to go to work. But, you know, there's probably going to be a large infrastructure program in this country, and that's going to open up a lot of jobs for the kind of people I place.
Sure, provided that we actually do that. And is it just an ideological thing that keeps people locked in the rut of, you know, it's not fair to ask them to work or whatever silliness they say?
I mean, yes, it is ideological. And on that one, I'm very critical of people who are on the left and many people in the Democratic Party who would prefer to see people getting handouts and seeing them getting the help to move them up in work. It is ideological, and it is unfair. And it is the people who want to be kinder and gentler instead of really helping people to get what they really do want.
But you look at the
ideology.
Yeah, because you look at the places where the long-term welfare and, you know, quote, poverty programs have. We were just watching a program last night, and it was literally they were driving through Detroit, just filming Detroit. What? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible.
What do you even say?
It gets back to, like, the whole Obamaphone thing. I mean, how many times have you seen people on the sidewalk or holding a sign and they're talking on their cell phone? I don't get that. How does that help somebody who's either on public assistance or living in a shelter? I would think a cell phone would be the last thing they would need to, you know, improve their life. I mean, they need a job.
That's exactly right. And what I'm suggesting is we get rid of all of that stuff, and we use the money to get people working, and then they can afford all of the things that are being given now.
Mm-hmm.
How much
like food stamps?
Have you done? I'm sure you have done the math for maybe not the whole country, but for a state, and if you converted their welfare budget or a city. How does that come out?
I actually haven't done that, but I've just been asked by the governor of Missouri to come out and take a look at their welfare program, and they'd like to revamp it. And it's going to give me the opportunity to see whether that could be applied on a statewide level and what they're spending the money on now.
Nice. Would you do us a favor, and if you do wind up crunching the numbers on that, would you send them to us? We'd love to post those.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, everybody doesn't always have time Sunday afternoon, but we post this commercial-free archive with all your information and the link to your book, by the way.
Great.
Because that, of course, would be the entire point here. If people really want to get the full story, you could find the book, Poor No More, Rethinking Dependency and the War on Poverty, by Peter Cove, C-O-V-E. Nice and simple there. And
they can get that on Amazon.com. They can get it on in their local bookstore and order it. And also they should go to our website, AmericaWorks.com, and take a look at what we do and how we do it and where we are.
Right. I was spying on some of that, and really interesting. And so, you know, for those folks that are driving or something, that's all linked up on our site there. And I hope people do investigate this, because honestly, people all over the country that listen, you're all represented by somebody who thinks that giving welfare recipients more money is going to solve their problems. I would hope you'd reach out to your elected official and ask them to read Peter's book
or take a hard look at it.
Make that big investment and buy the book and give it to them.
Hey, thanks for coming on,
and
Peter.
I just want to suggest that the book is a fun read because it's more of a personal book. It's not just all policy. It's a memoir.
Nice.
Outstanding.
Well, we're really looking forward to it. We hope you'll stay in touch with us as this develops, because I could see that we could talk about this a lot, especially if there's something happening at the federal level with legislation and you'd like to promote a take on it. Please get a hold of us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks a million. Have a great day.
I will, and I'll keep my dog out of the room.
No problem. All right, you've been listening to We the People. Please join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Send this show to your friends and family and get them all smartened up. We'll see you next week.
KCNR, Shasta Redding.